stuff. Yeah, so I think it's going to be a mixture of personal and technical. So I think maybe let's start in Israel. You finished high school, and what were you thinking about doing after high school?
Yes, so actually I was intensely interested in mathematics ever since I was either 11 or 12, probably 11 years old. I think I have related to you the story how I got there, which appeared in maybe in Out of Their Minds. I was kicked out when I was 11, say. I was kicked out of class, and in the hall between during class time, there were two students of ninth grade who were doing geometry problems, and I was standing there, and they were doing some geometry problem. I asked them what they are doing. They said they have to prove such and such a statement, and then they sort of condescendingly said to me, you think you can do it? And even though I never studied geometry, I was able to solve that problem. And the fact that you can, by pure thought, prove statements essentially about the real world. It was a problem about the distance between two circles. That by pure thought, you can, as I repeat myself, you can discover and prove statements about the real world, struck me so deeply that I decided I want to study mathematics. So I went, my father sent me to the best school in Haifa where I grew up, and in 10th grade I had the good luck to encounter a real mathematician, who somebody called Netanyahu, parenthetically between us, the uncle of the politician, who was at the time a high school teacher. Later on he became a professor at the Technion. And he conducted once a week a mathematical circle, so-called, where he taught us mainly number theory and algebra, but really advanced. And he lent me books. So among other things, while still in high school, when I was maybe 14, 15, I skipped a class, so I was a little bit younger than my than the students in my class. I read Hardy's book, Hardy and Wright, on number theory. I read the first volume in German of Landau's Zahlen theory. Mm-hmm. I read a wonderful book by Hardy, which is called Pure Mathematics, mm-hmm. Which was mainly analysis, and so on. So I was really very deeply committed to mathematics. I finished high school at age 16 and a half because the War of Independence broke out in Israel, and everybody in my class was drafted into the army, so they were between 17 and a half and 18, and I was 16 and a half years old, and I was a soldier during the War of Independence in the artillery, doing communications. Mm-hmm. Among other things, I also did very primitive encryption. In that communication, we had very primitive encryption systems. I continued to study math on my own, of course, while in the army. So then I got in touch, parenthetically, by the way, you know, you can draw up most of it, I'm giving you the whole picture. Yeah. Parenthetically, so I got in touch with Abraham Frankel, who was a professor of mathematics in Jerusalem. Are you worried about
this? Yeah, just checking. No, it's good.
Huh? Who was a professor of mathematics in Jerusalem, and whose book on set theory I've studied. And that was already towards the end of the war. That was in, maybe September 1949. So I was supposed to serve for 2 years. So I still had more or less a year, maybe a little bit less, to serve. But I wanted to study mathematics, and I felt that there is nothing useful I can do in the army any longer. And he met me, and he also got a letter from Netanyahu, who before that, many years before, was a student at the Hebrew University, a letter of recommending me. Mm-hmm. So he met me and examined me on group theory, number theory, set theory, and decided that it would be quite worthwhile if I come to the university. So he got in touch with the university authorities, and I got an early discharge from the army to go and study at the university. While at the university, at the time the system was that you went directly to a master's degree. This was like the German system. So I studied a lot of mathematics, set theory, algebra, functions of a complex variable. Much of it I already knew when I came to the university. And I was mainly interested in algebra. So I wrote a thesis in 1952. I wrote a thesis on the algebra of commutative rings. And I solved an open problem due to Annie Noether. Namely, just a little bit of jargon, characterizing, giving a necessary and sufficient condition on a commutative ring for having the property that every ideal is a finite intersection of primary ideals. Hmm. Never mind what the... No. And that was one of my first papers. It was submitted to the compte rendu, to the proceedings of the French Academy of Sciences, and an extensive abstract announcing those results appeared there. That played a role later on. Now, I was studying on my own logic, and I read Kleene's book, Metamathematics, including the chapter on computability and an extensive treatment, a wonderful treatment of Turing machines. So I also went and read Turing's paper. And as I also said in this little speech, I realized that Turing's model, Turing machines, are really the abstract model for the model stored program computer. All the features of the stored program computer are already present in that paper. Again, parenthetically, later on, after coming to Princeton and meeting both in Princeton and elsewhere, some of the people who were involved with von Neumann in building the first true stored program computer at Princeton, the one that later on was referred to as the Joniak, I found out that, of course, von Neumann knew of Turing's work. Turing has spent maybe 2 years in Princeton in the mid-30s. And that he, von Neumann, was deeply influenced by Turing's work. Again, how much time do we have?
An hour.
An hour? Oh, okay, maybe it will take a little bit longer. So, with respect to the history of the modern computer, there was the Moore School of Electrical Engineering ENIAC machine, and that machine was electronic, was constructed in order to do artillery trajectory computations for the army.
For Navy, maybe.
Yeah, for the Aberdeen proving grounds. And it was programmed by setting knobs and connecting or moving around wires, you know, in the style of the old telephone exchanges. They had a table where they kept electronically stored various constants, for example, like values of the sine and cosine functions, and maybe also values of air friction under certain temperatures. Hermann Goldstein, and this story I have from Goldstein, who is not alive anymore. Nobody is alive anymore except for us two. So Hermann Goldstein, who was working in Aberdeen Proving Grounds, took von Neumann to see the ENIAC. And von Neumann took one look and said, "Why don't you store the program in the internal memory where you are now, or in the style that you are now storing these constants?" Again, slightly digressing, what was the intellectual meaning of all that? How can you have a machine like the one we have today performing billions of instructions per second if the instructions are not also stored inside and accessible at the same speed? Then the speed of the processor does not make any difference, because you are not telling it quickly enough what to do. So I realized, coming back, that Turing machines are the blueprint, the intellectual model for modern computers. And So I wanted, and I did come to Princeton to study with Alonzo Church. I found Princeton was very, very selective at the time, still is, in admitting students. And every year only 13 students were admitted to Princeton. I found out later that the committee that was considering me assigned somebody to look at the Eminetter solution paper, and that this is what decided that I should come there. I was one of maybe two or maybe the only foreign students. Many of the others, they were all superb students, had NSF fellowships. So they gave me the highest fellowship for an entering student provided by Princeton University. In my thesis, I combined algebra and computability. My thesis was on recursive unsolvability, mainly computational unsolvability of group theoretic problems. So I did that very quickly, and I became an instructor there. I'll come to that in a minute. Now, in 1957, IBM, which had a small research lab in New York, sort of adjacent to Columbia University, decided to go in a big way into research. And they were planning to have what later on, what is now the Watson Research Lab in Yorkton Heights. And they sent down somebody called Roth, I forget his first name, to recruit promising students from top universities and top math departments. Am I going too fast?
No.
And he asked Dana Scott and me to come and spend the summer at IBM research. Watson Lab did not exist at the time, and the research was located in something called the Lamb Estate, also in Westchester County. This was appropriately before an insane asylum where mainly rich families would send, let's say, an elderly father who all of a sudden wants to marry a young, beautiful woman. So they had him declared insane and confined against his will. So at any rate, this
Temporary true. Do you know that for sure?
Yes. I mean, only by way of example. Later on, after IBM left, the so-called Hudson Institute, which may exist to this day, was housed there. And there was a very famous man who used to deal with, with issues of nuclear war and so on, who was head of that institute. I forget
his
name.
Kahn.
Not for pretty disgusting guys. I met him a number of times. I always suspect people who talk very fast because they're really pulling something over you. That was Kahn. Very good. So at any rate, the Lamb Estate. And Dana and I wrote that paper on finite automata and their decision problems. So there was already discussion of automata, and there was Kleene. So automata theory started with a study by Pitts and McCulloch of what you would now call neural networks. And they assumed about those neural networks essentially a finite number of states. And they talked about what is recognizable by such a finite state neural network. But they didn't have a full characterization. Later on, maybe 1956 or so, Kleene spent a summer at the Research Institute on the West Coast. I'm not sure which one. And he invented what are now called regular events, sets of strings, which are obtained from finite sets by some simple operations.
Not regular languages.
Regular languages. He called them events. Regular languages. And he showed that these finite neural nets, what they compute or recognize, are exactly the regular languages or events in his sense. So we decided to modeling ourselves on work by somebody called E.F. Moore. We decided to completely abstract away from it and have a finite state machine which accepts inputs and has transitions. And then if it gets from an initial state to one of a number of accepting states, then the string is accepted by the finite state machine. The finite state machine had no output except for saying yes, no at the end. And we also, let me digress for a minute. Remarks may be of interest to you, you know, if you ever teach computability. One of the less recognized contributions of Turing was that you have that finite control which, together with the internally stored program, can emulate any computation, the universal Turing machine. But what was of utmost importance is that finite control also had actually a very small number of states. So later on, there was a competition, you know, how few states are sufficient for a universal machine. Mm-hmm. But even if you and I would sit together now, we would construct a universal Turing machine with maybe 50 states. Now, that fact is of enormous technological implication. Because if a universal computer would require 10,000 states, I mean, the the processor or neural machine here has maybe 100 states. And then, of course, there are the reduced instruction machines. But if a universal machine would require 10,000 states, then maybe computers would never be built, because certainly the electronic technology, you know, radio tubes and so on, at the time, wasn't really sufficient to do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So the notion of a state, and coming back to Turing machines, that actually very few states suffice to build the universal machine, that was of decisive significance. Mm-hmm. But this is not my contribution. We decided so to look at finite state machines. And then we decided, don't use that term here, to really write the Kama Sutra of finite state machines. Mm-hmm. Namely, in what ways can we extend the finite state machine still below a Turing machine and see what kind of computations we get. So one of our extensions was to consider non-deterministic machines. We really did not have any deep philosophical reason for considering, even though, you know, non-determinism is now PNP, mm-hmm. is of central importance. For us, it was really one of the variants. So we said, all right, suppose the machine in state S and input sigma can go into S prime, S double prime, and so on, a certain subset of the set of states. And then the finite state machine, the non-deterministic, accepts if there is a possible computation, a possible sequence of transitions leading to an accepting state. And then we did all of that with lightning speed. The whole paper was written in 3 weeks, or 4 weeks. I mean, not written, but the research was done in 4 weeks at most. And then we proved that finite state non-deterministic machines are equal in power exactly to the deterministic machines.
Now, was part of the motivation also to model the Kleene regular expression?
No, it went like this. Especially with the notion of a non-deterministic machine, we were able to prove Kleene's result that finite state machines exactly accept regular languages. Mm-hmm. The proof became very easy. Mm-hmm. Not for this, but in your mind's eye, consider the following. Suppose you have two regular languages, capital A and capital B. And then one of the Kleene, one of the, or let's even take the hardest, you have a regular language A. Then A star, in other words, all the finite concatenations of words W1, W2, and so on up to WK, where W is in A, capital A, is also a regular language. So you really have to sweat to prove it. I don't know how Kleene did it. But now with a non-deterministic machine, you construct a machine like this. The machine is running, and from every final accepting state, it can switch into the start state, its own start state.
For the next language.
For the next. But these are, if the total word W1 up to WK is given, you don't know where this.
Yeah.
But the non-deterministic machine guesses the partitions. the commas, if you wish. And so on. Everything became trivial. Absolutely trivial. Now, for example, you can do it differently. But Kleene showed, say, that it's closed under union, A union B. So you build a machine which has two starting states, maybe an S0, and then it can move either into the starting state of the automaton accepting A, mm-hmm. or into the... Mm-hmm. and so on. Mm-hmm. Okay? So... But we also, for example, we didn't include it, but we had it in the original write-up. We were considering, for example, bounded tape machines. So the languages which are accepted if you are using a bounded tape, but you can erase and so on. So all of those variations were studied. And that paper became very, very significant. Maybe for 10 years it was one of the most quoted papers mm-hmm. in computer science. Carver Mead, who, you know, started in earnest that business of, circuits on a chip. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a book on that. He said that he was looking at those finite state machines and he was proving this and that, and then people came and told him, look, everything was done by mm-hmm. Ravenscott. Mm-hmm. So then the next year, Dana did not, I was still at Princeton, Dana did not want to come back to the land estate. I went there. Mm-hmm. And here is a historical remark about the evolution of computer science. At that time, there was a philosophically erroneous feeling that computing, and what later became computer science, is really a subfield of information theory in the Shannon sense. And that was really ill-conceived because Shannon was dealing with the information content of messages and so on. If you do a lengthy calculation, then the information content in the Shannon sense is very small because, you know, you can take a 100-digit number and having a big number package, you can raise it to the power 50 or to the power 100, so you get a 1,000-bit number. But the information content is no more than the original 100 bits. So, on my second visit to the Lamb Estate, part of that is being told in your out of their minds. McCarthy came and asked me the puzzle about the password and the styes. And I proposed the solution, which is that you take, let us say, a 100-digit number, and you square it, and you give to the girls the middle square. This was proposed by von Neumann, by the way, to generate
pseudo-random
numbers. And you give to the spy who has to return the whole number, and his verification is by giving the number, they square it, they check the middle square. And in fact, I mention it, I can send you the paper. I don't mention the McCarthy puzzle, but I mentioned this construction at the beginning of the paper that I'll describe in a moment. So the whole point is that it is easy to calculate the middle square, but it is difficult, given the middle square, to find one of the numbers having that as a middle square. But how do you even define that difficulty? And even more so, how do you prove it? So I set myself to study that problem, and I wrote it up only 2 years later. But I solved this, 1 year later I published an abstract of the result. I wrote a paper, that may be for me.
Hello? Yes. Yes, Sharon. Sure.
Hello.